Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Will we start with the good news maybe, because there's plenty of the other. So the Sunday Mirror has that great news. My darling Emily is broken but home in one piece. That's Thomas Hand talking about his daughter Emily, who, as you heard on the news there, has been freed from Gaza. The Sun on Sunday, hostage Emily free at last, on her way to be reunited with dad, and I think is reunited with her dad now. And then, so the Business Post has gone old-fashioned newspaper on the events in Dublin during the week with a front page comment. Dublin City on the edge, and it finishes up with, Dublin will recover from the horror of last Thursday for sure, and when it does, we need to treat our lovely, historic, troubled capital city with a little more love and respect. The Sunday Independent is going with the political aspect to this. McEntee and Harris on the rack as anger over riot grows. And then they are also this kind of subhead strap on that, is that a desperate call for reinforcements only made when city was already under siege. They say urgent requests for extra officers were sent out to divisional stations after 7 p.m. but at that stage a Garda car was already burning on O'Connell Street and the public order units were under attack from mobs throwing fireworks and flares. Gary Gannon made a very interesting point on Colm O'Mungon yesterday, which was that his office is an agriculture house, and he says that at 4 o'clock they were evacuated because of a fear of violence on the streets. So there was obviously a sense within official, the apparatus of the state, that there was going to be trouble. The Sunday Times, Emily is finally freed after 50-day Hamas ordeal. The Irish Mail on Sunday, ministers told Garda chiefs to get tough. They are saying that ministers expressed their unhappiness with the reluctance of Garda officers to aggressively confront the rioters who caused mayhem in Dublin city centre on Thursday night. And the Sunday World focuses us, and no harm, back on the initial incident, and the very ordinary heroics that we saw in Parnell Square. Angel of Parnell Square, witness says hero school worker put her life on the line for kids. And again, it seems that without thinking, threw herself into danger there in order to protect those children. Okay. Our panel today, Jack Horgan-Jones is a political reporter with the Irish Times. Yes, sorry, Jack, they don't have that. Bridget Laffin, the Chancellor of the University of Limerick, and much more besides that, but that is your latest accolade and title and role. Sheena Cattle is an Account Director with DHR Communications, and Hazel Chu is a Dublin City Councillor with the Green Party. And good morning, everybody. Before we get stuck into the actual papers, can we just get an initial kind of response. So Hazel, you, I suppose, connect with what happened on Thursday night in lots of different ways. You worked in the nighttime economy in Dublin for a long time. You were the mayor of Dublin. You were a resident of Dublin. You were also of an immigrant background and everything. With all that kind of going on, what was your response and what is your response to what happened on Thursday night? Just broadly, we'll get into the various aspects of things.
I think first and foremost, one crucial thing, I love your description there, is I'm a mother of a six-year-old. So I looked at the afternoon events of what happened and I was terrified and heartbroken, because this shouldn't be happening. Children shouldn't be getting stabbed on our streets. And bless the childcare worker, also Warren Dunhoe and Cao and Siobhan Kearney, the community that came together afterwards to protect the children. They're all heroes. But for me, it was that terror. I think the first response I had was to run to my own school and make sure my kid was safe. But then afterwards, looking at various messages that came in from people I know monitoring different spaces, it turns out that people were capitalizing on this horrific tragedy. There were messages saying, well, we need to go out. And it wasn't protest. They weren't saying protest. They were saying words like, we need to go and make sure someone hangs. We need to make sure politicians are brought down. We need to we need to make sure we protect the Irish. It was all, it was inside inciting hatred left, right and centre, and they were preparing and mobilising. I was in town on Thursday on the south side, Brendan, and I can see the smoke and can hear the sirens, and it was terrifying. It was terrifying for a lot of people we know, and
It was like nothing anyone had ever seen before, really. I know there have been incidents down the years and everything, but this did feel different to people, didn't it? Sheena, were you, you live in
Blackpits.
Were you around town? Or
I was actually. I'm on the board of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, and we had a board meeting on Thursday evening, and I came out of that and I actually hadn't, as a good board member I wasn't on the phone. And then I came out of the building, which is up by Leeson Street, and my whole WhatsApp had just blown up.
What time was that?
About 8:30. I'd like 200 messages on my WhatsApp. Sarah was calling me, my wife, to tell me to get a taxi home. And like that would be like, I'm 31. I've lived in the city for, you know, all my adult life basically. And I mean, I know that there's been talk about you know, the
safety.
Steady increase in concerns around safety in Dublin city centre, but I've always been very lucky in feeling that. I'm very privileged in feeling like I could walk home at night time and not feel like I was under threat. But I did get a taxi eventually and went home. But it's really grim. It's really scary. And I don't want to be one of the people who are like, oh, well, we told you so, kind of job. I take absolutely no pleasure in that. But I do think it needs to be said that it has been raised by minority groups for a long time.
Okay, and we listen.
That we need to talk about.
We will
this,
come
for
to
sure.
all that, and we'll give that the time it needs. Bridget, you picked that front page editorial on the Sunday Business Post. I think the Sunday Business Post, possibly because it's more maybe a business focused newspaper, it has more focused on the idea of the safety of the capital.
The safety of the capital, the reputational damage to Ireland of street violence. But in terms of what happened on Thursday, there was first the shocking incident where a young kid and a teacher and others were injured in ways that we don't experience, and then the mobilisation. But interestingly, I think in Ireland, we actually have very little experience of street violence. There's far more in many other cities in Europe. I mean, the French, if this was Paris, the French police would be ready and it would be very different. So that's the good bit. But the danger is that it's so fragile, that urban cities are fragile, and that once you lose control, you've a lot of people confined in small areas, and we clearly were unprepared to deal with what was not, by the standards of some continental European cities, a big riot.
Yeah,
and so that should worry
that
us.
That fragility is interesting. We had a great old public administration lecturer in college, Dick Haslam.
Yes, I remember Dick.
And I think Dick used to say that if you had 14% of people weren't prepared to go along with the rules of society, that the whole thing falls apart. It's a small number. Jack, I'm going to come back to you, but I want to bring up on the line, if you put on your headphones, guys, John O'Brien is a former Detective Chief Superintendent in An Garda Síochána. John, good morning.
Hey, Brendan and guests, good morning to you all.
John, so a lot of discussion now going on about how that was all handled policing-wise on Thursday night. What are your observations on it?
Well, listen, like everybody else, I'm absolutely horrified with the knife attack on those poor, unfortunate little almost infants. I mean, that is absolutely terrible. What followed is unprecedented in the sense that it was an attack on the guards as guards. Now, you know, guards are usually intervening to protect a building, a place or whatever, but this was actually an attack on the Garda Síochána. But before I do that, if I was talking to other than you this morning, Brendan, I'd be talking to Minister and Commissioner, and I'd be asking them like maybe two or three key questions. Number one, did you read the signs? And were you looking at the events over the last 3 years? And if you did read the signs, what was your analysis of what was happening? And
the Commissioner has said for a while that I think he mentions about 40 people who are the hardcore activists in this, and that they are being constantly monitored intelligence-wise.
Well, the question for him and for Minister is, what did you do about it? If you know there's an anarchist group within us, and we can see that's what happened on Thursday evening, which is very unusual development, a new development for Dublin, where they were able to rally using social media. What did he specifically do in order to be dealt with those? And what was the playbook? And then the second bit, which kind of relates, Brendan, to the dynamic of the right and the activities, what was his playbook for dealing with serious rights in the centre of a capital city? What was the playbook?
He would say the playbook was that they mobilised and had the thing under control within 2 hours.
Yes, but I'm afraid in terms of a playbook, that would be like the bit on the preamble, Brendan, yeah? So I would be talking about, did you have a recognised, trained and dedicated public order units? Did your individual guards have the protection?
Well, no, we have. We don't have a full-time public order unit, but we have guards who are trained in public order who mobilise in situations like this.
Well, I can tell you from my own experience and from my research and my academic research and that wouldn't come anywhere near the plate. That would be, you absolutely need to have a specialist capacity available in a city of nearly 2 million people. It is unconscionable that you wouldn't do that. But I would like
so
to
John,
ask...
So, John, is that the big learning out of this? Because I think I have heard other ex-guards and security people saying that actually there is a lacking in our policing, and it'll require resources and everything, but that we have to have a dedicated unit on standby, ready to scramble for situations like this, which is something we don't really have at the moment, yes?
And Brendan, to be, you know, we did have that capacity and we did have that capability in Dublin and we did have that capability around the country. It's clear it's been stood down. I mean, the clear thing, I think one of your speakers mentioned it already, is the lack of good uniform visibility on our streets and our towns and in the country. I mean, when the guards or any police force are forced through inaction or otherwise or leadership to see the streets to people like this, then that is a huge danger for democracy. And this is well understood in the literature. Like, there's nothing new in this. But back to the playbook.
Yeah, tell me about the flashpoint model, John.
Yeah, the flashpoint model is based on a lot of research, and it's a very simple theory, which goes something like this. In society, or in a part of society, there's been underlying conditions of dissent and disgruntlement, for a long time. Yeah, and then when one particular incident happens, typically it's when there's an overreaction or seemingly overreaction from the police, this thing just simply boils over. And that is the typical typology. Now, it was different on Thursday, but it does speak to the presence of this seeding discontent. And when that happens, then it boils over and the state and the police have to deal with with that as an incident, and not to understand that that's what is happening. Now, of course, look, there are other factors that play into this, the economic crisis, the housing crisis, all of that. But that's what the flashpoint model says, is it's happening underneath the surface. And that's why my question was addressed to the Minister and Commissioner. Did you not read the sign? Did you not know that we were on our way to this kind of day?
OK. John, will you stay with us, and we'll go back to the panel on that. So, Jack, before we get to maybe the political aspects of this, what has been the kind of outcome of the policing aspect of this and everything now? Like, what's the general gist today in the papers, would you say, and what's the feeling?
Well, I think that it's inevitably layered on top of a lot of pre-existing concerns about the city centre, how it is policed, concerns about the industrial relations between the Gardaí and the Commissioner. Obviously, we had that unprecedented and landslide vote of no confidence in the Commissioner. And not necessarily the adequacy of budget provision for the Gardaí, because as is so commonly the case these days, it's not a money issue, we're told, but the capacity of the Gardaí to attract, retain, train, equip their personnel to a standard that's seen to be adequate. And there's another couple of issues bubbling away. For example, you know, this tax treatment of pay and pensions in the Gardaí, which is preventing or discouraging people to apply for the top roles. And all that is kind of layered together and thrown in with what happened, you know, which was a riot, obviously. And the very clear vista that confronted the whole country on Thursday, which was that the city centre, they lost control of the city centre, is my view. And that becomes an enormous political problem, I think, for those who are responsible in an operational sense, but also in a political sense, for the security of the state, because it's very difficult to get past or get away from the vision or the images and the footage of buses burning on O'Connell Bridge.
Okay. Hazel, you picked a piece here, also in the Business Post, Ian Guider, Dublin City businesses will suffer as air of menace grows. So I suppose, look, it's kind of emerging that there are two strands to this, if you will, and it was an unholy alliance maybe of both. But I suppose this piece is kind of focusing on the notion that was the North Inner City being ceded, C-E-D-E-D, to bad elements anyway, like?
I don't think it was being ceded to the, you're saying bad elements, I'm just going to say mob. So I think...
But is this part of the, like you know, Helen McAtee saying this is not about the streets being safe, this is a separate issue. Do you think there is a continuum over what's been going the pandemic in Dublin City
Centre? It's all connected. You can't say this is not about this when it's all connected into one. And trying to separate it out is just folly at this stage. You look at the overall build-up of what has been happening between everything from various factions to on the street in the city. And you mentioned COVID there. We had a period where during COVID, the economy of Dublin was on its knees. After that, we started slowly building. What we really need, because there was a huge safety element that people were concerned about, was a proper nighttime economy. Because your nighttime economy increases the footfall into the city, makes people feel protected, makes the city feel more vibrant. And also in terms of the other relating issues of cleanliness, of whether your Dublin is worth visiting, it makes it worth visiting. Your businesses, Ian's point was, this will bring Dublin City businesses to its knees. Dublin City businesses are already on its knees. And what we need is a pathway to make sure that we have daytime, nighttime, all building to make people feel safe, but also for the retailers to be able to be supported and the workers. Because at the end of it, it's not just the business, it's the workers that are part of the business. We need to make sure we can retain that workforce, make them feel safe that they can continue working in that workforce as well.
So that's one side of it. That's the safety of the city. Sheena, you were bringing up then the other aspect of this, which is far right agitators.
Yeah, and I actually, Dr. Orla Lynch from UCC actually had a good piece. I felt
in the Sunday Times.
Yeah. She talks about the fact that, you know, she sees that dealing with the far right is less a police issue and more of a societal issue, and that riots and violence are at the end point of a long and complex process. So that did speak to me. And it's because I think it's been really easy for us to come out and call everyone who was involved on Thursday thugs and things like scumbags. And I think that the bang of classism about that for me ignores the fact that while absolutely...
Why is it classism? They weren't saying everybody in the North
there
in the
cities. There is an assumption, Brendan,
a lot
that
of the people involved in this, when we saw who was arrested and everything, weren't from the North.
But it took us...
The people who did that were
sure, and I think a lot of people would like to think that the reason why they put terms like that on people is because of the actions that they've taken rather than their address. But I don't
You wouldn't agree.
I don't. I think that most people would like to believe that these are just, just disaffected young fellas who don't care less anyway. I'm not suggesting that the lads who went in and looted Foot Locker, you know, were there because they had a strong political ideology in relation to nationalism in Ireland, and that they had also a strong opinion on the safety of women and girls. I'm not saying that. But I think that there is a breakdown of social cohesion. It was said by the president during the week. I think there is, and it's something Hazel just talked about it there, the feeling of safety in Dublin, the inability to feel that all groups are being treated with respect and equality. I think there are so many communities in and outside of urban areas across Ireland who feel extremely left behind, who feel that the services and supports are not there for them. And of course, this is a breeding ground in many, many regards for people to feel that they're part of something when they are responding to the call in WhatsApp groups and Telegram groups around the country on Thursday, whipped up by the likes of Conor McGregor. And that's covered quite extensively across the papers this morning in the Sunday Times and other places.
Sheena, John?
Yeah, you know, I'm listening to the debate, and it is very interesting to see and hear the different perspectives. But let's be clear about one thing. is that from a policing point of view, you need a pragmatic approach that's based on the reality of what's facing you on the streets. And you need to have the capacity to deal with it, because while all of the other factors exist, and I'm absolutely certain there is an anarchist group, and that has to be dealt with by the Garda Síochána, who are responsible for policing and security in the state. That is a separate exercise, and that has to be done. Okay. But the idea that there's kind of random social factors at work that in any sense would legitimise the kind of thing that you've seen on the street, you've got a big problem in this country.
I don't think Sheena was saying it legitimises it at all. I think she was saying that.
I'm just saying is that often we get lost in the debate when we're faced with a really pragmatic thing for a number of years.
We've looked at the pragmatic side of it, but I am interested in as well in exploring the other threads there are to this. Bridget, in terms of the broader picture of, if you want, how the far right works, okay? So there are people saying, look, most of these people who are involved in this riot have no political allegiance as such, right? But would it be the case that, like, I don't want to invoke Germany, but that what can start as thuggery can build into a far-right political movement and people get swept along in it? And Sheena's thing there about people feeling belonging to something.
Well, we absolutely can't be complacent in this country on the far right, because we've seen it develop over many decades in other countries, and it's ugly. But I think that there isn't a single person on the radical right in Ireland who would save their deposit if they stood for election. So that's a good thing. They wouldn't actually be democratically legitimised, in my view, in this country. But that doesn't mean that you can afford to ignore them. So there's a playbook. They first start by developing a them and us. There's another. Usually the other is people of immigrants. They then, their second line is there's an establishment versus the people. And the third line always is simple solutions to everything. So that there's a standard playbook. And then underneath all of that, in the radical right, you can all also get menace. So they want to intimidate. They want to intimidate with language, as we saw in Ireland over the last period. They want to intimidate by standing outside libraries, by interfering in direct provision centres, etc., etc. So I think we absolutely, as a society, have to develop a zero tolerance.
So back to what John O'Brien is saying, that we need a hard policing response to any of this? Is that the actual kind of crux of it initially?
So on policing, we have always had, fortunately in Ireland, light touch policing, largely unarmed police force. But we're now a very significantly larger population, a more urban population and a more complex population. And I honestly don't think that the guards had an appropriate riot plan prepared for what happened on Thursday night, either in terms of equipment or in terms of ability to mobilise quickly enough. And I just contrast that whenever you see an equivalent in Paris and you see the big helmets. And it's, you know, there is a strong sense of state power. So
a lot of other European countries come from a very different kind of history and background. Just have a very different kind of policing and very different numbers of police and techniques.
Exactly.
And we have, and as you say, we've always really tried not to have that in this country.
So
we need to get over ourselves.
Do you agree with that point? Is that the model here has always been policing by consent? That's the essential model. But that doesn't mean. That doesn't mean we don't have either the thinking or the capacity to understand that there will be events that have fall far outside policing by consent. And that's why I was asking the questions in relation to that.
Okay,
Jack, hang on. Let John say something very briefly and then come
this
to you.
This is very important.
Yeah.
I have to send out my best regards to Paddy McMinnon, who was the chief superintendent in charge in Sorcery that evening, and to the guards who were on the front line.
Okay,
they were as much the victims as were the industry and the country itself. They really were in an unenviable.
Absolutely, and nobody is questioning that the guards involved in this like really took one for the team there, Jack.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Brendan, yeah.
So as I was saying, it's right and proper, of course, in the wake of something like Thursday, that a lot of the coverage and a lot of the commentary will focus in on the policing response on the ground, because that's where the riot took place. But I think there's another element to this. I mean, since the kind of far right issue emerged in Ireland, the government ministers have been left, right and centre out saying that there's a small group of provocateurs
who are
yeah. involved in mobilising and organising these protests. I mean, this is a state that has a history in dealing with subversive challenges, and there are intelligence-led approaches. And I think in the wake of Thursday, I mean, why is the state not trying to build cases against this small group of people? You know, that is a policing response that I think, like because if they don't, and if they are saying it's this group of people, but that group of people aren't seemingly being interdicted,
we're watching.
You're advertising your own uselessness, really.
And it's not just politicians. Stu Harris has said it a couple of months ago, saying it was a minority group. Again, it emphasises that it's a minority group or far right, a small group, and there wasn't prevention. So we look at how to tackle far right. What we also need to look at is our, to Bridget's point, policing. It's not just about riot policing. What about the community policing? Because we have been, to John's point, community by consent, but we used to have some amazing community guards in this country. We used to have community guard departments that were stacked with people who knew which troublemaker, shall we say, in which community are.
And knew their families.
And knew them and knew how to deal
so
with them.
So move back along the process before they get to Footlocker.
Can I just say, Brendan, that I don't think it's actually good enough now to say that just because we don't have them elected to the Dáil, that, you know, we can pat ourselves on the back and think that this illusion of Ireland as being this very centrist, very progressive country of communities that are accepting of everyone, that exists in its entirety. It doesn't. I think that was shattered this week. I think a lot of people have been saying it. People, and this is not just happening in Dublin. People listening from around the country in rural areas will be saying that, oh, right wing doesn't exist in my community here in Longford, when actually they're sharing disinformation on a regular basis, even in their own WhatsApp groups. Yeah. This is the thing. Being right wing doesn't mean that you're kind of aggressively wearing, you know, an Ireland for the Irish t-shirt and you're going around telling everybody that you're anti-vaccine. There are so many small insidious ways that Bridget already went through, where it's about the Achilles heel of the fear that people have in communities. If that fear is that the jobs aren't going to be there, then we identify that simple solution that it's the immigrants who are taking them. And at the end of the day, it's all about boxing down. It is never about looking at the people at the top.
The jobs are there at the moment. That's the other part of it. Jack, the one thing I do want to get in here as well is you picked out Colin Murphy in the Sunday Independent, but there are a number of pieces around about it. But basically, perfect storm of disaffection and the cynical tool that amplifies it. The part played by social media in pouring petrol on all of this.
Yeah, the Colin Murphy piece is really good because he went into town on Thursday and he went around and there's just a lovely bit of reportage in it as well, you know, the on-the-ground stuff. But the point that he's making, I suppose, is that you do have that group of provocateurs, and then you have a kind of a latent degree of I don't know if you'd even classify it as support, but, you know, they've clearly figured out the modes, means and methodologies of mobilising these people at short notice. And, you know, we saw it to a degree outside the Dáil, we saw it in Sandwith Street, and now we've seen it writ large. But I think that, you know, there is a question here for the social media companies, and that can sound a little glib sometimes, but, like, you know, these are the channels through which misinformation is spreading at light speed.
I think it's more than just mobilising the people involved, though. I think everybody else on Thursday night was high as kites, sitting at home, the temperatures raised and everything, sharing all these videos and everybody getting
hopped up
on everything. Yeah.
Speaking
of the social media companies, Hazel, just before we finish up on this, you picked a piece in the Mail on Sunday on page 6 about Elon Musk.
Yeah, it's a small piece.
Who I think is becoming a very sinister figure in all of this.
And this is the problem here. Colin's piece, and Jack pointed to it in relation to the social media companies' responsibilities. You now have an owner of one of the largest social media platforms that have, 168 million followers on his account, tweeting about how the Irish Taoiseach, he called him a PM, which is ridiculous, but Irish Taoiseach hates Irish people. that is inciting hatred and violence among certain people. And on top of that, he then started engaging with a number of far-right accounts. So this comes down to the fact that this man who has a large amount of influence, like other people that have been mentioned on the show, is outwardly inciting hate, and we're not doing anything about it. And this needs to go to the commissioner of the media. This needs to be looked at by the government parties, because I think at the end of the day, whatever about using the platform to share disinformation and lies, it's a different thing when you have someone of such influence pushing out these issues.
Yeah, and listen, the idea that Commissioner Naman or anybody else is going to stop this, like, let's face it, you know. John,
just a quick word before
final word before we go.
Yeah, Sean, I'll be short. We don't have time or space this morning, but people should recognise that the Garda Síochána itself has been in crisis for the last 2 or 3 years. And that really needs a far more mature and strategic look at than, you know, it's possible to do in a short programme this morning. There has been a major, major crisis in the Guards, and it is not going away anytime soon.
Okay, Bridget, did you want to say something there before we go to
so
the break?
I think what we're seeing is, and it's not just the Guards, but also the Army and the Navy, and across the Irish state, we've a growing population, very changing. I think the Irish state, in terms of services, is under extraordinary strain. And I think it's right across the full gamut of public policy. And we need to ask ourselves, why are we best in class with the IDA in foreign affairs and NTMA and whatever? But when it comes to services in the country, our public services are under considerable strain at the moment.
Okay. I just want to read the text here before we go into the break. And I think this is a point worth making. Texter says, there is a wonderful, hardworking and thriving multicultural society in Dublin One today. Please stop the hysteria. Why allow thugs and extremists to dominate the media agenda? And that is a very valid point of view. OK, we'll take a break. John O'Brien, former Detective Chief Superintendent in An Garda Síochána, thank you. And Jack Horgan-Jones, Bridget Laffin, Sheena Callan and Hazel Chu are staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel is still with us. Jack Horgan-Jones, Bridget Laffin, Sheena Cahill and Hazel Chu. And I'm joined on the line now by RTE's Fran McNulty from Tel Aviv. Good morning, Fran.
Good morning, Brendan.
So after 50 days in captivity following her kidnapping by Hamas, Emily Hand is free. Do we know what has happened, where she is, Fran?
She was taken to a medical facility last night, Brendan, and people may have seen that video of her run into the arms of her father, Tom. Last night it was released in the early hours of this morning. They are still at that medical facility, we understand. And the Israeli government are very keen to give these hostages space. I mean, you have to consider what a child of Emily's age has been through over the past 50 days. And the families as well. I mean, it has been absolute mental torture for the families, in particular for Tom Hand, having had the news that she was possibly dead, then the news she was alive, everything he had said in between, that he went on the road campaigning, saying everything he could to put the pressure on to get her out. And now, I suppose, for the families, it's giving them time together to try and get their heads around what has happened. So, really, we don't know an awful lot. The Hand family are keeping fairly quiet since Emily was released last night, and they're taking that time to spend time with her.
And in the meantime, Fran, a diplomatic row has broken out now between Israeli Foreign Minister Eli Cohen and Taoiseach Leo Varadkar.
Yeah, an extraordinary row, Brendan. Leo Varadkar issued a statement last night in which he spoke about Emily Hand being recovered, and he said that she had been found and returned. He said his actual words were, an innocent child who was lost has now been found and returned. And within a couple of hours, that was seized upon here in Israel. I'll give you an example of it. This morning, we were driving from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv, and it was on the radio. It is a massive topic of conversation when people realise you're Irish here. And what Eli Cohen has said, he has actually accused the Taoiseach of trying to legitimise and normalise terror by not saying she was kidnapped as opposed to being lost.
Yeah, OK. Fran, as your reports went on during the day yesterday, concerned and kind of looking more and more unsure about what was happening. So the process hit this bumpy patch and became uncertain yesterday. Obviously, there's a lack of trust on both sides. Is there a sense that the whole process of the ceasefire and the release of hostages might be back on track now?
It's back on track. I mean, Hamas issued a list of names to the Israeli government last night. The Israelis have handed a list of names to Hamas as to who will be released. But some fairly senior Red Cross figures who are in Gaza have said they're not confident that more hostages will be released today. It's a very volatile situation. You're not dealing with clear lines of communication. Some senior figures in Hamas were killed within the past 48 hours in Gaza. That has increased tensions there. And when you hear, you know, an agency like the Red Cross saying they're not confident, that is a fair indication that we could have yet more difficulties this evening. The handover is meant to happen at around 4 o'clock Israeli time. It was 7 hours beyond that last night, and I would expect that we won't see a crystal clear situation this evening, but that just remains to be seen.
So then the notion that this could go on for more days after the initial 4 up to 10 days with the release of further hostages, that's looking a bit more of a distant possibility now, is it?
You would think that, but Qatar is talking that up, as is Egypt. And Egypt talking about needing to find a long-term sustainable peace solution for Gaza. And Anthony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, who has been in Israel numerous times since this war broke out, he's back next week. And that visit is about possibly extending the ceasefire period. We understand that Hamas may be able to access pretty quickly an extra 30 hostages. And if that were the case, that's another 3 days of a truce. And if you could extend it out to that 7 day period, who knows? But when you hear what Israel is saying and the chief of staff of the Defence Forces here saying, as soon as this ceasefire is over, we're back in and we have a job to do in Gaza. So Israel very determined to get back to dealing with Hamas, and which inevitably will lead to further destruction and death in Gaza.
RT's Fran McNulty in Tel Aviv. Thank you very much, Fran. Back to our panel. Bridget, the piece you picked, and Jack and Hazel picked it as well, is the Sunday Times page 13. And it's kind of about Qatar's role in all this, really. Before we get to that, did you see the footage yesterday of the markets in Gaza?
No.
So, you know what? You were struck by the extraordinary resilience of people, right? Once stuff started coming in, and clearly it's not all aid, it's trade as well, right? So traders were able to get fruit, vegetables, everything, bagging up what looked like spuds and everything, saying, oh, the prices have come down now because stuff is... And people were out trading again. And you just thought, isn't it horrific that in 2, 3, whatever days, that all stops again? And
yeah. It could stop, and one has to hope that with Blinken and also the Egyptians and the Qataris are clearly working overtime, that if you can extend it, the longer it lasts, the harder it is to go back.
Okay.
So I think that should be the goal, to try and just extend
it. One day at a time.
But I think what's really extraordinary is that we've suddenly woken up to how politically important Qatar is in the region.
And how cute they are.
And interestingly, part of it was modelled, believe it or not, on the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland. They became very interested about 5 or 6 years ago in peace processes. And of course, Northern Ireland, the peace process was one of the things. And they thought, Qatar thought, if they could position themselves as a peace broker in the region, it would be to their benefit, because they have very strong ties with the Americans, but they also have very strong ties to Hamas. And what I find extraordinary, and it really is, it exposes and reveals in a very serious way just how weak the EU is in the region, because the EU funds the West Bank and Gaza. I mean, the civil servants wouldn't have salaries without the EU. But when it came to this conflict, it really was Qatar, Egypt and the US that have heft when it comes to try to get stuff.
Because the EU couldn't come up with a common position, and or because they're not seen as an honest broker in a weird way. Are Qatar seen as a kind of a pragmatic, honest broker here?
So obviously Qatar are nearer Hamas than the EU would be.
Yeah.
And so that gives them, and they house the political wing of Hamas. So they've real purchase there. They have guys in Qatar that they can say, we will expel you or whatever. You know, they can put a bit of pressure. But for the EU, once this is over, when it comes to reconstruction and trying to overcome the enormous destruction, it'll be EU money again that will be looked to to support the reconstruction. So I think for the, and this is the EU's neighbourhood, I mean, it's not nowhere, it's literally the other side of the Mediterranean. So I think for the EU in terms of its desire to be a player in international politics, this is very salutary. Now, it's in contrast, in stark contrast, to the role vis-à-vis Ukraine.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Jack, you picked that piece as well.
I did, yeah. It's a really well put together insight into the kind of back channeling that was going on and the way in which the government here was, you know, pulling on those various levers and reacting to information as it emerged. Obviously, the most salient piece of information being the fact that Emily Hand was alive, because we all were labouring under the misapprehension that she had been killed in the initial attack, and the efforts, I suppose,
and the Qataris was it gave that information to the government. The government kept quiet.
It was slow played, which is very interesting. Yeah, and then there was this question about, not over her citizenship, she is a citizen, but, you know, when the passport was awarded, when the application was made. Apparently the application was made by her father before the attacks, but all this was kind of submerged to a great extent. So this piece begins to kind of prise back, you know, a little bit of the veil that was put over those diplomatic efforts, because I and others were trying to cover it in real time, and any briefings we were getting were kind of very much limited to the geopolitics of it. The fine detail of it was kept under tight wrap, and there was huge nerves across government about this as well. Just nerves that saying the wrong thing at the wrong time, or even intimating it, or, you know, as we've seen today, wrong words being taken up and weaponized, you know, could have thrown the whole thing, or at least could have been a headwind to the efforts to put it back together.
Hazel, a win for the government there?
I think a win for a government, but also a testament to diplomatic relations work. I know there's been a lot of calls on expelling ambassadors and other things, but when you look at it, this is why those links are important, be it that you may not agree with the Israeli government or the ambassador. It is why those channels are still important, because we had citizens that we needed to get back. But on top of that, this piece also showed that pressure works as well, international pressure. And you have the Qataris there in this instance. But if you look at back in the Carter days, it was America, and it was American pressure that had a piece deal with Egypt in the return of Sinai. So that international pressure needs to happen. And Bridget has said that the EU doesn't have that power. What we need to look at is America, Qatar, and try to push that pressure on Israel. Because at the end of this, the ceasefire, like the IDF has, the chief IDF have come out recently to say, listen, after the ceasefire, they're going to continue the attacks. And that is something that, well, we need to stop. So, but in the longer run of things...
Their defence minister came in a dinghy and strutting around in Gaza.
And in the longer run of things, we need to look at the occupation and how that is stopped as well. Because this isn't just this war, it's the effects and thereafter and the aftermath of what happens, because the occupation is illegal. It's agreed by the DALT, it's agreed by the UN Security Council, it's agreed by the International Court of Justice that it is illegal and it has to end.
Okay. excuse me. Jack, before we take a break, the poll in the Business Post today, you were just going to give us a rundown of that.
Yeah, so it's margin of error stuff, but, you know, the trends matter here as well. So the headline from it is that Sinn Féin are down 3 points, 3-point drop to 29%. Fine Gael unchanged on 20, and Fianna Fáil up 1 on 16. One of the interesting things that Richard Caldwell, who is the managing director of Red Sea, which is the polling company that runs the polls for the Business Post, has picked out is a drop in support for Sinn Féin amongst younger voters. Now, I didn't actually see the figure spelled out anywhere, but this is a trend that he's saying is important among the 18 to 34s, which is obviously a constituency that has been strong for Sinn Féin. I think in our own polling in the Irish Times the last time out, I think it was around 44%. So it's still very strong. But I think it does maybe speak to some of the problems that Sinn Féin face into, which are front runner problems as you enter into the election cycle proper, right?
This could be an anti-establishment vote, and that it could go it doesn't necessarily go to Sinn Féin.
Yes, exactly. And like, I mean, just to not necessarily dwell on the migration stuff, but that's a space where Sinn Féin are in a little bit of difficulty because, you know, I think instinctively, obviously the leadership is nowhere near kind of being anti-migrant, but there is a view within the political science community that a lot of the support base may have, you know, latent concerns or there's a saliency of the migration issue for them. So where does that vote go? Does that dissipate to independents or new parties? And then, you know, there does seem to be this, just to return briefly to the issue around youth vote, Richard Colwell picks out the strength of the Social Democrats as well, who are polling at 6%. They're polling lower with us, but they're polling 6% in Red Sea. So, you know, if there is a place for the youth vote to go that doesn't necessarily have some of the baggage that people would associate with Sinn Féin, but does speak to a lot of the kind of anti-establishment or certainly very strong in social justice, strong in housing, all those kind of things, and led by a potent political brand in the form of Holly Cairns, then perhaps that's something worth tracking as well.
And that Red Sea poll, there were 1,021 people. They were surveyed online and it was the 17th to the 22nd of November, so it was before the riots happened. Bridget, very, very briefly, you looked at that poll as well, but there is another figure in it, which is that I think it suggests that 62% of people think we've taken enough Ukrainians. It has been kind of consistent in polls recently of people are now kind of starting to say that Ireland has taken too many migrants, right?
Yeah.
Whether that's right or wrong, that the polls suggest this. How do the mainstream political parties handle this in the run-up to an election?
So the tendency in Ireland is to, in a sense, almost avoid discussing migration, and that's not a good strategy, because then what you do is you dampen down sentiment in a population. But what you've got to do is, when discussing immigration and emigration, you've got to do it without racism. And so it is like any area of public policy, it is legitimate to discuss. We know, and we've seen in the Netherlands, numbers matter. They, you know, so we can't ignore that. But we've got to find a way of discussing the nature of Irish society, how it's evolving, in ways that are respectful, but also that address issues around public services, etc., etc.
Okay.
Integration is hard.
Integration is hard.
Yeah.
And education is the core to integration.
And so is planning.
And planning, yeah. Housing, services.
Yeah, Sheena, go on.
No,
that.
It's just that I think, you know, I think there's a memo due to go to the cabinet this week about, you know, the plan for the management of Ukrainian refugees. And you know, when you read a sentence like that and you're like, lads, we have known about this for ages. And how is there, like, I mean, I know, and that's me being extremely reductive to an incredible amount of work going on in the conglomerate of a department under Roger O'Gorman. But I think there's a plan that needs to be put in place. We know the numbers that are here at the moment. We knew the numbers that were going to be coming in for quite some time and we weren't planning for it. And you're dead right, Jack.
Okay.
You know, integration is not something that happens overnight. It has to be embedded in communities, into the education system and into our politics as well.
Politicians are really good at intuiting where Middle Ireland is at. They're exceptionally good at it. And you do find increasingly...
Quick bite on that before and I need to take a break then.
Like, you have all the politicians talking, you have the various communities, but you also need to bring those who are immigrating in into the conversation as well, which is a gap that we've seen in various communities. What you have seen in various communities is, be it a direct provision centre or a refugee centre, that there's a centre, there's people in the centre, there's people outside, and there's a barrier in between. So there is no...
There's literally
one or another. And what this government and various representatives need to start doing, and this is not just a government party issue, it is a all-party issue, needs to start uniting. What we've seen last week and the horrifying events of last week and talk about immigration is we need a proper unifying leadership conversation on the issue.
Okay. Got to take a break. Jack Horgan Jones, Bridget Laffin, Sheena Callan, and Hazel Chu staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us. Jack Horgan Jones, Bridget Laffin, Sheena Callan, and Hazel Chu. Sheena Callan, page 10 of the Sunday Times, Patrick O'Donoghue is writing about scams.
And yes.
Let's tell everyone. I'd
like to know how many people under 40 in the country don't regularly get a text from their mother or their father every day, indeed, over every second day, like I do, saying, is this a scam? With a screen grab of a text. And inevitably, my message back to either of my parents is, yes, Dad, please do not click on that link, etc. What I'm talking about is that Patrick O'Donoghue in the Sunday Times has a piece on the sophisticated scams, particularly online, particularly via your mobile. And the alert really is for ahead of the Christmas shopping. Now, we just seen Black Friday happening in Ireland. I just have so many issues with Black Friday that I won't get into here. But in terms of online fraud, I think it's always useful when you have the opportunity to, I suppose, evaluate when you click things, what you're clicking, when you're shopping online, that if something is an irresistible offer, you should triple check whether you should be spending your money on it or putting in your credit card details. And, you know, the reality is that what Patrick is saying is that, you know, not only are we seeing an increase, 70%, Central Bank have reported a 70% rise in reports of fraud since last year, but also that these scams are getting just more and more elaborate. So, for example, text to parents saying, hi, it's me, Mum. I've lost my phone, or my phone is broken. New number, just picked up my friend. Like, it's all generated to sound nearly in the voice of a person of a particular age. Now, indeed, I've gotten one of these texts and I do not have any children, so I was surprised to find out.
Would we say in general to older people, maybe don't click on any links?
Don't click on
anything.
AIB banks, Bank of Ireland, lots of them are investing a huge amount of money now into advertising around this issue. But please use check.cyberskills.ie if you want to check any verification of the site.
Thank you very much to my excellent panel today, Jack Horgan-Jones, Bridget Laffin, Sheena Cahill and Hazel Chu, for that very lively hour.